Hello and welcome to our program About Books, brought to you by Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Kathleen Schock with co-host
Lana Collins,
and during the next half hour, we will be reading articles from the San Antonio Express News and talking about
books,
and more books.
Well, we're going to begin today, Kathleen, with a writer's Enduring Greatness. This Houston author will explore the ebb and flow of Larry McMurtry's life. And the book is titled Larry McMurtry, A Life by Tracy Daughtry. Published by St. Martin's Press with 560 pages at a cost of $35. Our review is by Brian Burrow, who writes for the Washington Post. And Mr. Burrow is the editor at large at Texas Monthly, and he lives in Austin. To be a Texas writer these last 50 years or so is to labor beneath the branches of the great Larry McMurtry Oak. Even now, 2 years after his passing, his influence and his presence are inescapable. Practically all the older writers I know here in Austin are 1 or 2 degrees of separation from McMurtry, either a pal, one of his many female companions, a target of his barbs, or just someone trying to explore a niche he left untouched, which isn't easy given an aura that stretches from The Last Picture Show and Lonesome Dove to Terms of Endearment and the screenplay for Brokeback Mountain. The question I've heard lately, though, is, how good was he? I mean, really? The editor, Michael Korda, once termed McMurtry, only half jokingly, quote, the Flaubert of the Plains, unquote. Others invoke Tolstoy. Lonesome Dove has been called, quote, America's War and Peace, unquote. But while he produced several classics, they represent only a small fraction of his enormous output. And the rest of it, especially in his final decades, was seldom of the same quality. A can of Dr. Pepper and a Hershey bar beside his typewriter. He wrote his famous 5 pages every morning, and every year the books, often sequels and prequels to his greatest hits, kept coming. Much of it was dreck. Quote, Rhino Ranch, unquote. Anyone? There's a debate here about how we judge artists, whether by the entirety of a career or its peaks. But McMurtry's valleys are too many to overlook. In the pantheon of post-war writers, he probably doesn't deserve a seat beside Miller, Vidal, and Capote. But the Austin novelist Stephen Harrigan, one of his accolades, suggests comparing him to Wallace Stegner, another Westerner whose prodigious writings, many thought, never got enough respect from Eastern literati. Maybe McMurtry's journey from childhood on a North Texas ranch through teaching post at Rice University, running a bookstore in Georgetown, and his final years in Tucson is told capably in Houston author Tracy Daughtry's Larry McMurtry, A Life. This is the first McMurtry biography, probably not the last, and better than most quick turnarounds. The author of biographies on writers, Donald Bartholomew, Joan Didion, and McMurtry's Austin pal Billy Brammer. Daughtry has a good grasp of Texas literary history and the cooperation of those closest to his subject. If his prose is unadorned and his approach profoundly middlebrow, well, so was McMurtry's. McMurtry was a bit of an odd duck, and not just because, like many creative types raised in rural America, he never truly fit into milieu. Too country for the city, too city for the country. Coming of age in the 1950s, his people were hard-pressed and hard-bitten. Cattlemen and their wives, the men wistful about the cowboys passing, the woman less so. The themes that fueled his work were those he grew up with. McMurtry was a classic small-town bookworm, a tall, gawky kid with heavy black glasses and a thick head of black hair. He did his chores, but with little braille, and was so unsuited to ranch life, his parents gave him no trouble about going off to school in Houston. I grew up in Central Texas, 3 hours south of McMurtry's hometown of Archer City, and I recall the moment when it hit me. Wait, I can write for a living? Daughtry does a nice job tracing McMurtry's own realization, all but living inside Rice's Fondren Library, poring over Dostoevsky and Henry James and Cervantes. By the time he entered graduate school, he had completed his first two unpublished novels. For a writer who invested in his every fiber in the physical book, endlessly scouting and reselling them, even running bookstores for much of his life, it's ironic that with the notable exception of Lonesome Dove, McMurtry achieved far more fame from Hollywood's versions of his stories than his own. His first novel, Horsemen Pass By, drew acclaim. One reviewer brought up Willa Cather. Although the book did not sell particularly well, once Hollywood made it into the Paul Newman vehicle, HUD, McMurtry's success was assured. The same dynamic fueled his next hit, The Last Picture Show, a little-noticed 1966 novel transformed into a smash 1971 movie. Daughtry's book is dominated by three themes: McMurtry's writing life, his career as a bookseller, and his relationships, especially with those women. The first is solid, the second a snooze, and the third kind of fascinating. After the failure of a post-undergrad marriage, McMurtry amassed a large and varied group of close female friends, including the actress Diane Keaton and Sybil Shepherd, and the writers Maureen Orth and Beverly Lowry. Some relationships were romantic, others eased into platonic, But the long phone calls and letters he lavished on these women, Daughtry demonstrates, were the core of McMurtry's emotional life. His friendship with the boorish Ken Kesey gets far too much space in this book for my taste. Into his 40s, McMurtry concentrated on what he knew best, the tensions between Old West and New, the dying ranches, farms, and small towns, what was lost as American life transitioned from rural to urban. Then, after years of demystifying the frontier, he bowed to its allure. Lonesome Dove, published in 1985, was a massive bestseller and a landmark television miniseries. It made him an icon, the supreme chronicler of the West and of the dreams found and lost there. It appears, took something out of him. One senses McMurtry's inspirations were already ebbing by 1991, when he underwent a grueling heart bypass surgery. Daughtry makes a compelling case that this was the turning point in his career. Afterward, he suffered a crippling bout of depression, staring out windows much of each day, which is when Diana Ossana, a woman he had first spied dining at a Tucson restaurant, enters the frame. When Ossana, until then an unknown legal writer, began co-authoring McMurtry's novels, many in the publishing world were aghast. They debated whether she was a gold digger or the second coming of Yoko Ono. The reality Daughtry shows was neither, by taking him into her home, if there was a romantic interest, it was brief. Ossana rescued McMurtry's career and maybe his life. Once he recovered, they wrote together seamlessly. By the 2000s, spurred by Ossana, McMurtry was more active than ever, which wasn't always a good thing. The reviews of his late books could be scathing. One prominent critic for the New York Times, Dwight Garner, said that, quote, "A lot of McMurtry's stuff verges on being, how to put this, typed rather than written," unquote. If the partnership of McMurtry and Ossana left a mixed legacy, Ossana deserves credit as the force behind by far the greatest triumph of McMurtry's late career, The Brokeback Mountain screenplay, for which they shared an Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. She also was involved in a string of McMurtry-derived television movies, not all gems. Variety dismissed one, Comanche Moon, as at times cartoonishly bad, I suspect few Texans give a whit where McMurtry ranks as a writer or whether his hits outnumber his misses. He's given us so much. He's cared about his reputation, but not obsessively. For years, his favorite thing to wear was a sweatshirt emblazoned with, quote, "minor regional novelist," unquote. I love that. It not only speaks to his innate humility, it's a sentiment many Texas and mid-continent writers can identify with. When he died, I printed up 40 of the shirts myself and gave them to writer friends around town. When I see someone wearing one now, It reminds us both of the long life and reach of Larry's Oak. And again, once more, that book is titled Larry McMurtry, A Life by Tracy Doherty.
Now from the West, we're going to go to the world of finance. We have a new finance novel that speaks on a personal level. The title is The Counting House, and it's by Gary Sinovitz. The review is by Michael Taylor, who is the San Antonio Express News columnist with the Smart Money SA column. Michael says, "This is my favorite finance novel of the past few years. The central character of The Counting House, who's identified throughout the novel as the CIO, is in a personal and career crisis as the manager of a university endowment. Once upon a time, the CIO, chief investment officer, managed to beat the market for a few years. In addition to securing a comfortable pay package, he got a hagiographic New York Times write-up as his reward. Unhappily, ever after, however, he has languished in financial performance mediocrity. Lately, he has underperformed. That is his perseverative fear." I met the Counting House author, Gary Sinovitz, a few years ago when he visited San Antonio to make a presentation on the oil and gas industry. In his day job, he is a managing director of Houston-based private equity firm Lime Rock Partners. I read an advance copy of this novel. While I recommend it to anyone interested in the overlapping themes of a finance guy's midlife crisis and competing philosophies of investment management, I have one big fear. Was this specifically written for me in the most micro-niche targeted way? Like I might enjoy and relate to this book more than anyone else on the planet. It speaks to my interest and experiences in banking and finance. First is its level of specificity to the hedge fund, private equity, quant fund, and asset allocation characters of the 2020-2023 era. Sinovitz name drops everybody who was anybody during that period. We meet, as the CIO meets, representatives of practically every institutional investment strategy of the past 25 years. Via the CIO's jaundiced viewpoint, we get Sinovitz's most skeptical view of each, and all his skeptical views are very much worth reading because they are funny, insightful, and multi-layered. Although an asset manager himself, the CIO stands at a critical distance from these giants of investment management. He doubts everything about their strategies. He allows for the possibility of genius, but assumes that luck and timing played a greater role in their rising reputations. The central question of the CIO's inner monologue, "To what do we attribute above market returns?" is the defining finance debate of our times. The protagonist is an asset allocator. He picks the managers who implement the strategies, but he's deeply skeptical of even that role. Is he exercising a skill? What is that skill exactly? For people like me who find markets exciting, yet who have read the research on efficient markets and find most investing strategies absurd, this debate is everything. Everything. In this particular way, the philosophical market question underlying The Counting House seems micro-targeted to me. And people like me who love the markets but also understand that most of what we humans do to invest is kind of a hocus-pocus that mesmerizes and entertains but ultimately offers worse risk-adjusted returns than pure stock index funds. Are a few tens of thousands of people similarly obsessed with this question? I hope so, which would give this novel the broad audience it deserves. The protagonist's fear of underperforming or actually losing money also makes this book particularly appealing to me. It is difficult to explain to people who haven't been fiduciaries for other people's money just why this is particularly torturous. From the outside, it probably looks like a big first world problem when you lose money for wealthy people, institutions, and yourself. Well, boo-hoo. So sad. But, like, did anybody die? No. The CIO is tortured. I have been similarly tortured. When you lose in this game, you feel like a failure. You question whether you have any skill at all. Was past success just an illusion? Were your assumptions made about skill mere self-deception? Investors are generally not naive. Being naive or self-deceived is the worst character flaw for any investor to admit to. Was I unlucky? Did I have bad timing? Or was I the dumb money in the situation? Is attempting to achieve risk-adjusted returns, those that beat an index fund, ultimately a fool's game? Certainly, I have concluded, in good company with my main man, Warren Buffett, that the vast majority of people and institutions shouldn't be trying to beat the market. They do not have an edge. That's always my advice now that I'm on the merely advice-giving side of things rather than handling your money for you side. The novel builds to the CIO's meeting with an Oz-like character, a billionaire wizard of the markets who does have an edge. He consistently wins, and he prefers to interact with nobody. He has a lizard-like personality devoid of warmth, just pure market genius. His energy derives from the screens of his Bloomberg terminal. He has no time for human interactions. He is, in Cernovich's depiction, a horror in a human shape, practically oozing a sulfurous smell. Devoid of every human weakness or human vulnerability. He cares nothing for the uses of money, either consumption or philanthropy. He is a pure market creature. I appreciate Cernovich's thought experiment. What lies at the very center of everything? What is the purest expression of capitalism? Cernovich is a capitalist. I know this not only from his day job, but from his 2016 book, The Green and the Black, which celebrates the fracking revolution, and which I also highly recommend. He also clearly enjoys these contradictions. Can you be an investor but acknowledge the absurdity of it all? Can you be a capitalist, but acknowledge an inhumane lizard brain as the clearest expression of the philosophy. Can you find something worthy in a lifetime's effort, but constantly critique it? These are questions possibly better addressed through fiction than philosophy. Sounds interesting. If you have that bent to invest and try to figure out how to beat the market. Once again, the title of that book is The Counting House, and it is written by Gary Cernovitz.
Wonderful. Well, you have been listening to About Books, and on our OWL Radio, you can listen to OWL Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Excuse me. And we thank you for listening. This program will be replayed between 8 and 10 p.m. this evening. This is Lana Collins with co-host
Kathleen Schock
saying
goodbye from OWL Radio.